I heard a couple of sighs out there about the interesting times we live in. Any of you who follow my podcast, you probably know Shyla Catherine asked myself and three other Dharma teachers if we would start 2020 off by teaching on the Four Noble Truths. My job was to teach the first noble truth. I was very happy, actually, teaching about the nature of unsatisfactoriness. It was quite fun. But any of you who listen to my podcast, I actually uploaded that Dharma Talk as the first episode of 2020, episode 29, the Groundless Ground podcast. After that one went up, you know, during that talk, it was a little frustrating for me, right? Because I couldn't offer any antidotes. I couldn't say how you can go beyond it. You know, I just really had to stay with unsatisfactoriness. So there were several times in the talk when I would say, don't worry, this all sounds a little dire right now, but it's coming. So I got a lot of requests from, I guess, people who listen to my podcast. Would you teach on the other three noble truths so we can hear it too? I have taught on the other ones before, years ago, maybe even here, I don't know. But I really started to think about what's been happening over the last couple of weeks with all of the Uber buying and hoarding and all of that. And I thought, the second noble truth, this is kind of it. People are so lost. And so I thought, well, okay, I am going to teach on tanha, or craving and aversion, with a little bit of a twist, because I know you guys know about the second noble truth. So I'm going to start with the twist. Do not get lost is the essence of working with craving and aversion. Don't get lost. That's the twist. Okay, now you can all go home. But what does it mean? Don't get lost. According to Buddhism, tanha, which is the Pali word for craving and aversion, and in the second noble truth, it only says craving, by the way. Tanha is craving. But for those of us who are psychologically minded, approach avoidance is a thing. Human beings have approach and avoidance. Craving and aversion, approach and avoidance. They exist side by side, and they're all characterized in the Buddhist teachings as one word, which is tanha. According to the teaching, craving and aversion reflect our discontentment with our perception of here and now experience. That's not normally the way tanha is described, but I think this is a more sophisticated view. Yes, we have base instincts, but I thought it might be good to kind of dispel what I consider not misunderstandings, but maybe something a little less complex. I'm into complexity. Two basic questions that we're going to try to answer tonight. Does craving and aversion arise because actual experience is not to our liking? Or does craving and aversion arise because our ingrained cognitive, affective habit perceptions, which we bring to here and now experience, are not to our liking? Well, is it actual experience we don't like, or is it what we bring to actual experience that we don't like? We have one vote for second. We'll see if by the end you still say second. I'm not actually sure, just so you know. According to the Theravada teachings, there's six classes of craving and aversion. The craving and aversion that comes up with form, craving and aversion for sound, craving and aversion for smell, craving and aversion for taste, craving and aversion for tactile sensations, and the last one is craving and aversion for ideas. So you could see there's a correlation here with the six sense bases, and in Buddhism, mind is a sense base. So all the internal phenomena that arises is considered just like the sounds. It's just it's arising internally. So in order for us to answer these questions that I just posed, we first really have to talk about Vedana, which is the feeling tone of all experience. And of course, Vedana, it has subjective content, And it's experienced as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Anything we perceive always has this valence of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Vedana is interesting because it kind of constitutes this crossroad. It's a bifurcation point. And it either leads to proliferation of unhappiness, or it can lead to the eradication of that unhappiness. This is the thing. Vedana in and of itself is not negative or positive. It just is. It's part of our wiring. So at this point, you are not necessarily going to suffer just because the experience you're in has a feeling tone. And in fact, there's a few Buddhist scholars who insist, when they look, there's no support in the suttas that Vedana necessarily leads to craving and aversion, even though, according to dependent origination, if you have Vedana, you're going to end up in craving and aversion. When they look at the suttas, it turns out that it is sensation that appears to be the proximate cause of craving and aversion. So I thought I would give you an example of one of the places where the Buddha basically makes this pretty clear. So this is from the Digha Nikaya, verse 58. And this is the Buddha talking to Ananda, his cousin and closest attendant. So the Buddha says, with sensation as condition, there is craving and aversion. This, Ananda, should be understood in the following way. If there was no sensation at all of any kind anywhere arising from any one of the six sense bases, then would craving and aversion be discerned? And Ananda says, definitely not. And then the Buddha replies to Ananda, therefore, sensation is the cause, source, origin, and condition for craving and aversion. That unconscious feeling tone is not enough for craving and aversion. So if you follow this through, you might deduce that from that perspective, sensation is the thing that dictates the emergence of liberation from tanha or getting lost in it. In the Abhidhamic way of looking at cognition and the way mind perceives, according to them, objects exist. And then there are the sense organs, your five sense organs, that actually are the gateways through which objects come into our perception. If you see these two things along a line like this, our ability to be conscious of objects, this is at a very unconscious base level, but our ability to have objects come in, that is this base kind of consciousness, according to the Buddhist teachings. And these three things kind of converge in this thing called contact. Contact is the point at which there is something in the system that knows it's made contact with something. There's a percept, and this is the point at which there's contact. It's called vasa. And sensation is the next thing down the line. It's kind of weird. Sensation is not quite the feeling tone of experience. It's almost a recognition. And actually, recognition is the next thing. But it's this deeper, unconscious recognition that there's something happening. Something's coming in. This is very complex, according to the Buddhist teachings. The recognition, which is sanna and vedana, they kind of go hand in hand. It's so fast that it's hard to believe they actually separated all of this out and distinguished it. That cognitive faculty, which is sanna, that recognizes, percepts, and then facilitates what's called concept formation. It isn't until after sensation and after sanna that you actually even get to concept formation. At this point, it's just information coming in. That's the point at which we actually start to react. So, I mean, like a really good example is you're walking along one of the beautiful trails we have here, and your body perceives something out there. It kind of looks like a snake, but you're not close enough. You're not really close enough for the body to detect it's an actual snake. You're not aware the body has detected something that looks like a snake. You are not aware of it. The body's aware that there's something out there, and it's in a shape that it's at a very base level it doesn't like the look of. And it isn't until after concept formation that the body is in its reactive position around snake. And it will engage you pretty quickly so that you can be consciously aware to look carefully and see if it's a snake. Once you see if it's a rope, a limb, a snake, that's going to obviously dictate what you do. In this case, if there was a snake in front of you, it was an actual snake, you would not be lost in craving and aversion, trust me. There would be no craving and aversion. Would you agree? You would just get the hell out of there. Or you would be frozen because you're too close and you can't move, and now you've decided it's better to stay still and hope it doesn't bite me. You are not in craving and aversion. Reactivity toward experience is not the same as craving and aversion. Because a snake in front of you, well, I mean, it could be a terrible experience for you, but it's not going to cause you suffering, trust me. There's no time for suffering in this. You're in the immediacy of your experience, and it's either going to be really bad or it's going to be the best day of your life because the snake didn't care about you and just moved on. That's not craving and aversion. You understand the difference? This is important. Because I think sometimes people think they're supposed to be this, you know, completely equanimous, non-feeling human being to not have craving and aversion. But it isn't true. We're still in a human body. So in order to answer the question, does craving and aversion arise because actual experience is not to our liking, or because ingrained cognitive, affective habit perceptions we bring to here and now experience are not to our liking, we really have to just look at the three kinds of craving and aversion. So the first kind is called kama tanha, that's K-A-M-A, tanha. And this is the drive toward pleasurable experience. You walk into your friend's kitchen and the first thing that hits you is this amazing smell of bread. It's just come out of the oven. I'm sure you all know the amazing smell of bread, right? Is this a pleasurable experience for most of you?
Sure.
It's overwhelming, this amazing smell. What is the first thing you feel? Think about what is the first thing I feel. When I walk into my friend's house and there's an amazing smell of fresh cooked bread. And I want you to feel the feeling for yourself right now, okay? Feel the feeling. And now, I want you to ask yourself, what's the first thing I think? So how many of you, the feeling was different than the first thing you would think? Right. And so, your feeling was?
Well, I was salivating.
You were salivating.
It was just a bodily experience. But my first thought was, I want some.
Why is that different? Your body wanted it and you wanted it. That's exactly the same. Why is it different?
I didn't feel like the salivation was a going towards it.
Interesting.
It was just like a reaction, like a, you know, smelling.
You had a machine experience. You were programmed when you smell that smell to have salivation occur. So for you, this is just conditioning. And there was no, oh, smells so good. That was the second thing you had, was a thought, that smells so good. Okay.
Not I want, just pleasure.
Just pleasure.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes?
I'm feeling so happy to be in that kitchen.
So your first thought is about the bread or about the joy of your friend having made bread?
Well, it's the smell. I want to stay in that kitchen.
That's craving and aversion. I want to stay in the kitchen. That was great.
Yeah.
Yes. I never want to leave this kitchen. This smell makes me so happy, I don't want to leave. That is Kamatanha.
For me, I was thinking of when I walked by Acme Bread. I really like that smell, but I don't need to have it or favorite it. I just like it. It's nice. I enjoy it. That's all.
Yes. That is not craving and aversion. So these two experiences are a perfect example of what is and what is not. Both of you had Vedana. You both had this experience basically is pleasant for me. One of you had, I want to stay here forever. I don't want to leave. This is why Vedana doesn't always necessarily lead to craving and aversion. Thank you. I should have written the script for this. It's perfect. Thank you. Somebody else wanted to say something. Was there another hand raised?
I was imagining, oh, it smells so good. It's delightful. And here I am. Did she do it for me?
Well, on the other hand,
I don't want to. She may have special plans for this baking that she's been doing. And I may just be in the way of that. And so there was that aversion.
Okay, you got all three forms of tanha in there. Thank you. I'm going to use your example. Kamatanha basically is the drive toward pleasurable experience. Another complexity about Buddhism is that tanha is different than clinging. Craving is different than clinging, according to dependent origination. But in the Four Noble Truths, craving and aversion include clinging. You realize the Four Noble Truths, this lecture was given like 3 weeks after he woke up. So there was his first shot at it. And then he had many years to come up with all these more in-depth formulas. When you're looking at the Four Noble Truths, you really have to recognize that tanha in that context is craving and clinging together. Oh, this is so great. And then the clinging is, I just want to stay in the room. So for our purposes tonight, I want you to think of tanha as craving and clinging. The key here is continuance. It's not just, I love that smell. It's so nice, right? That's Vedana. It's so nice. The key is the clinging to the continuance of the experience. I have to stay in the kitchen. The kitchen has to be here. The smell has to stay. This all has to be this way in order for me to be happy. The second form of tanha is bhava tanha, the drive to become. And bhava, some of you know the term bhavana, right? Bhavana is such a great thing in Buddhism, cultivating your desire for practice, right? You know, your desire to wake up, that's bhavana. So this is the desire to become. It basically implies the existence of a subtle or blatant dissatisfaction with whatever current conditions you've got on board. Even in your beautiful example of the smell and I want to stay here, the smell in this moment is not enough. There's an unsatisfactoriness about the smell in this moment because I'm already worried the smell's not going to be here in the next moment. And that's why I just want to stay in this kitchen forever. I want this experience to just be static and stay this way. This incessant need that we have. Make the next moment just like the one we're in because this is perfect. Or this is not perfect, in your example. This moment would be better if I was 10 pounds lighter. So then I could actually eat some of this bread. Or this moment would be better if I wasn't gluten sensitive. Then I could eat this bread. So you can see how the dissatisfaction takes many, many forms. And the desire to become something other than what you are in the here and now. And whether that's somebody who can tolerate gluten or somebody who's thinner, So that you can basically follow through on this pleasure in a way that will give you the happiness you're seeking. Which is the whole problem, really, with craving and aversion. There's always some idea about the happiness you're seeking. This is the becoming that's not actually in the here and the now. And if it is in the here and the now, it has to stay this way and not change. And so this is the two forms of becoming that really trip people up. One of the things I wrote in my textbook about Bhava Tanha, Buddhist psychology is very, very clear to keep reminding us that when we forget the magnificence of our own being, just as it is, we get lost and believe false ideas about who we truly are. So the third form of tanha is the drive for non-existence. And our beautiful example over here really showed non-existence, right? That elaboration, this is what Buddhist psychology calls it, elaboration. It's a bunch of thoughts, right, that start with the basic feeling of what a nice smell. And by the time your crazy thoughts are finished, you've already told yourself a story about how you're not deserving anyway of this bread. And actually, it's probably being made for someone else. And this is a great example of mental proliferation and how it gets involved, craving and aversion. Mental proliferation in the 12 links of interdependent arising is different. Here, the Buddha's being very simple in the Second Noble Truth. So he's including all these ways in which craving and aversion show up, whether it's in our thoughts, it's in our ideas about ourselves, whether it's in our feelings about ourselves. There's so many ways in which craving and aversion can show up. So your example was such a beautiful example. You started with something so lovely and simple, and then your mind took you on this whole narrative about your friend, what they were doing, about you. And by the time you were done with your thoughts, you were never going to have any of that bread because you didn't deserve to have any of that bread. So how familiar is this? Well, those of you who are clinicians, how much do we deal with this in the room? A lot. Those of us who are human, how much of the time do you find yourself lost in this kind of mental proliferation? Story making about me and mine, them and theirs. It's crazy making, yeah? It is important to say, the first time a child puts their hand on a hot stove, what is going to happen to their hand? And at the first sensation of the burn, what are they going to do?
Hold their hand.
Exactly. This is not craving and aversion. This is just our basic instinct to survive. It's different. Craving and aversion would look like, years later, this is an adult who can't go near a stove. They're too afraid to go near a stove. There's no problem with them going near a stove. Stoves are fine. But in their mind, the stove is the worst thing that ever happened to them. And they can't trust themselves and they can't trust the stove. So they are lost. This is the lost quality. Okay? So in this case, in fact, you are correct. It is the second form. What we tend to bring to actual experience that causes us the suffering of craving and aversion in this case, right? Because the stove is just a stove. It is not a cause for suffering or violence, except in that person's mind. And how often do we do this? A lot, wouldn't you say? About all kinds of things. So the Bhava Tanha, this desire for non-existence, is very important for those of us who work in the realm of psychology. Because so many people walk around in their daily life either not wanting to be in their existence, wanting another existence, or they just don't understand the beauty of existence. And because they don't understand the beauty of existence, they live in a perpetual state of non-existence. So this is a form of clinging. Clinging to the idea that life is not enough. That the beauty even in the pain of life is not enough. And even just that sentence, not enough, right, is so indicative of craving and aversion, wouldn't you say? It's like a coyote. It's very wily, craving and aversion. It has so many forms, so many ways it shows up. All three of these forms very often will lead to what I call craving a fix. The habit of needing to fix or needing a fix. That need to fix. On the one hand, the mind sort of does it automatically, right? Especially if it's rejecting what it perceives. If the mind is lost in aversion, the first thing that mind is going to do is figure out how to fix the experience, don't you think? It's true. This is approach and avoidance. If I don't like what's happening, I'm either going to try to fix it, make it something I like, or I'm going to try to end the damn thing. Maybe I will try to get away from it, or maybe I'll just avoid. You know, these are your basic choices around this. But all of them are a fix. It's a little frustrating, right? So how many times have you heard your Buddhist teacher say to you, if you just let yourself be with the basic experience, it'll be better. Is there anyone in the room who has not heard a Buddhist teacher say this? And it's a double-edged sword. I mean, really, don't you think? It's mostly true because the kind of craving and aversion that was demonstrated in the beautiful narrative that started out with sweet-smelling bread and ended up with I'm a schmuck. You know, this narrative, all of that mental proliferation that went on in that mind is usually the thing that drives our need to fix. Because we're inventing problems where there are none. A lot of people invent problems where there are none. So they're always involved in this, I have to find a way to make this more comfortable, or I have to find a way to do this. If you drop the whole project of fixing, believe me, your physical pain gets less. Your emotional pain, honestly, it's kind of not really there. And your mind settles. It's a little bit of a Jedi mind trick, but it's actually true. I mean, I teach this in the office all day long with my patients. So I know that this is true. If you directly recognize how much you're trying to fix, and then you really ask yourself, is this a fix anyway? And you drop the whole project of fixing, much of the distressful nature of our perception of experience just falls away. And experience is just experience itself. So your Buddhist teachers are right. On the other hand, let me just say, there's real things that need to be fixed, don't you think? So then the key becomes, remember, Vedana is not necessarily going to lead to craving and aversion. Climate change, you know, my Vedana around climate change is very unpleasant. And I could get lost in a lot of things around climate change. And it would impede my ability to be part of actually making a difference there. Or, how about this? Well, I might get quarantined at some point. I don't really know. So in case I get quarantined, I think what I'll do is I'll go on Amazon, I'll buy up all the masks, and I will also buy up all of the wipes, and then I will be safe. That sounds like a fix, right? Unfortunately, it's a really bad fix because hospitals don't have enough equipment, they don't have masks, and whoever was out there mass buying this stuff for me and mine, they were not thinking about who really needs it. If you've got coronavirus in your hospital, believe me, you're going to have to be completely gowned up. You are not going to want people in the middle of nowhere to have boxes of masks. Think about the insanity of it. This is craving and aversion on steroids. I'm going to buy up as much of this. I'm not thinking. The truth is, everybody else has to sanitize their hands too. So if you buy it all up and no one else, when they go to the store to get hand sanitizer, can get it, this is a problem. But this is craving and aversion. Coronavirus is unpleasant. It's what you do with it. That's what makes the difference. whether you're going to suffer or not. All of this was driven by fear, correct? Think of the two questions. Real fear, actual fear, or imagined fear? Which is it? Like, really do the calculus on this one.
Most of it's an imagined fear.
Okay, you have company. Obviously, for you, it's the second one. What the mind brings to actual experience. Even if it's the nice smell of bread, the mind can then go to all of these concerns, quote unquote, yeah?
This all sounds like so much.
Right.
That it almost can't be done with the mind is where, right, you can't do this with the mind.
Which thing can you not do with the mind?
Can you really make equanimity? Can you do that here? Or this has to come from a different source?
You know, in Buddhism, there's no separation between mind and heart.
Really?
That is a distinction from Western psychology.
Wow, I thought that was a distinction from my own experience.
Well, you are a Western person with a Western psyche. Welcome to the sickness of the Western psyche. Good for you. Yeah.
Sounds like I have a Western heart.
It's the separation piece. That's all. It's the acculturation. You know, you can never discount acculturation. You know, I work with a lot of men, actually. And sometimes when they're in the office, I will look at them and I'll say, there are times when I think patriarchy was much worse for you guys than it is for women. Because we're told to be nice, which is bad enough. You guys are told you can't have your feelings. You're told any kind of emotion is weakness. This is an acculturation that men in the Western world have been bestowed from about maybe 3,000 years ago. And it's just built and built and built. So I understand why you experience that separation. But what I can tell you is that the capacity to know is beyond thought and it is beyond feeling. It is beyond both your separative view of mind and heart. Your innate capacity to know is there no matter what. It is beyond your ideas of yourself. It's beyond everything. Beyond meaning it's untainted. It cannot be tainted by any perception that arises within it. And it's an equal opportunity employer, so everything can come from the worst of the worst to the best of the best. The clarity that supersedes everything. And all the things we're talking about tonight, craving and aversion, mental proliferation, ego making, all of that comes after. I know, it's kind of weird, isn't it? So fear is real. So any Buddhist teacher who tells you there's no such thing as fear is wrong. It's real. Fearfulness is not fear. These are two different things. So craving and aversion and clinging are the proximate cause of fearfulness. All the story making we do is because of fearfulness. It's not because of fear. So the people who overbought all those things, this was their reaction to the not knowing, to the inability to predict whether or not they might get into a situation where they would be sick and asked to stay in their house for 14 days. There was no actual existing condition in the moment that required them to buy more than one thing of hand sanitizer. It would have been enough, but not for a mind lost in the continual upset of craving and aversion, the fearfulness that arises from confused perception. If the Buddha was alive today, it's possible the Second Noble Truth might say confused perception is the cause of unsatisfactoriness. I mean, I'd like to think that's what he would say, because ultimately that's actually the way it is. It's confused perception. Whenever you hear tanha or craving and aversion, you can think, oh, confused perception. I am confused about the nature of what is occurring for me right now. either internally, some story about myself or some story about the world, or even something showing up out there that I am not an omniscient being, so I don't know everything about the thing, and therefore there's some level of confusion. And in order for me to make sense of it, I have to elaborate in some way. And that may not be an accurate elaboration. Hence, the ubiquitousness of tanha. That's the, I think, the good news or the bad news. I don't know which one. Maybe it's both. Question, yes.
But if I'm on a cruise ship and everyone around me is getting ill with this virus, it's probably appropriate to have fear.
But you know, this is why you practice, right? You practice for these circumstances right now.